Mr. John Paris, 92-16, take 36.
Today is January 29th, 92. Could you please state your name and age?
My name is Juan Namoli Paris. I am 71 years old now.
Could you please let us know you were early December 1941?
December 1941 is December the 8th. That was Sunday. That was Sunday, yeah. I was the Pan American Airways. I was the chief boatman at the time. We just released the Canadian twin-engine bomber heading for Australia that morning. That was early. And then we secured the barge, and then we got to the dock. I late evening manager, Charles Craig is the manager of the Pan American Airways at the time, and I let him off the dock, so he immediately went to the office. But prior to that, we heard rumors about Pearl Harbor was bombed, but we don't, you know, those are just speculation rather than the actual truth. So then immediately, Mr. Greg called us in, all the airport manager called us in, all the maintenance crew, after we secure everything. And he revealed the messages that Pearl Harbor was bombed by Japanese. And he gave us a very brief instruction of actually how to act in case an airplane drop a bomb. Very simple. That just in case, he said, if a bomb would fall, airplane will release a bomb, make sure that either lay down flat and make sure that, because the shrapnel will actually fly on top of you, or indirectly. So actually that's what we did. I was when he announced that we heard the airplane noise humming. You know, we're very sensitive of airplane because the noise, actually we're used to it, you know. So finally some of us got out of the administration building, and we peered our ears up to the sky, and then we all of a sudden we saw one airplane swept down, and I know that he released a bomb because the first bomb that actually was dropped at approximately 100 feet or less next to the flagpole in front of the administration building. I was wounded. I was struck by shrapnel on my left hand side. Actually penetrated, went through on my left side here. And Mr. Wesley, John Wesley, got hit on the stomach, and his intestine started coming out. And Anderson got hit on his leg, and it was amputated later. Another person was struck by shrapnel was Chaffers. I think it was Bill Chaffers was the guy. The other one was struck by, as he was running, is Balhaja. Balhaja was struck by, I think it's a machine gun. I tried to help him, but I went over to Balhaja, and Balhaja was laying, you know, he's dead. So I turned around and tried to pick up Bill Chatfors. And he was struck on the back, so I don't want to lift him up. I tried to save him. I tried to get him out of the area. So finally, I start proceeding back to my home and pick up my family, my children. And we went to the cave in behind the church in Santa Rita, in Sumay. And all half of the resident in that area. And so I started hiding behind next to the church. Along.
I'm sorry, when I
Early.
Oral History, World in the Pacific. This is Mr. Paris. 92-17, take 37.
You were talking about gathering together and then hiding in
Sumo. Oh, yes. During the bombardment, after I got away from the Pan American area, I proceed to my house and pick up my three children. My wife went to the cave behind the church. Also, many of the families in that area in Somai, they were heading toward that direction. I don't know how many of them, but a lot of them were in there. And then after that, after the airplane left, a lot of part of the afternoon, the crew, many of us went back to make a survey of the area, and then we know actually what happened. And the boat actually that was operating wasn't hit. The hotel actually, it's a nice hotel, a one-story hotel, but that was totally damaged, and the reef, all those areas. The Japanese did very little damage bombing of the area. They bombed a few houses, like Antonio Baleto's house was bombed, and my mother-in-law house was bombed. But the area actually, the loss of, I'm talking about the structural area, the house is minor compared to what happened, you know, when the American invaded the island. And you want me to go ahead and proceed of actually what took place during that day? That morning after the Japanese bombers move out of that area, the contractor trailer picked up many of the families. They load them in a trailer heading toward Fina Valley and transport them there, leave them there to hide. And then families, really, they don't have food. Actually, it's plenty of food in the area in Fena, because that place is rich in everything, shrimp and deer, a lot of things up there, you know, that people can survive. Those are the things that I remember. The other thing, after we got back to surveying the Pan American, we check on our things, whether the mess hall is destroyed, like I said, and the family was disarrayed. A lot of the families were, some of the children were getting me account of that during that day, because we never experienced anything like that before. We never experienced a war. The war we have probably is on a family basis, but not a total war like that. And we heard the following, that night we heard the Japanese are ready to invade the island. And we saw some ships outside, but we cannot identify whether it's an American ship or Japanese, because we're not used to that, you know. But we used to see the American flag, but at a far distance. We feel that we thought it's an American ship, but no, it isn't. An American ship probably is the Japanese, and there are a whole lot of them. So finally, when they invaded the island, the people actually didn't know what to do. Then that day, the day after that, a Japanese army and their truck came up to Fina Valley, and Cristobal Napthi and I was shooting dice, you know, I mean, just try to kill the time. So finally, this chief, he is the chief in charge of the PT boat, a PT boat, came in and was going to surrender. I want to be honest, but he said, why they surrender? You know, we try to ask him to stay away. He says, no, I'd rather be a living coward than a dead hero. So that's his business. So finally they picked me up. You know, no, before that time, that evening we went to Sumaya and started scrunching some of our food because, you know, we're out of food at the time, when we're traveling to Fena. So finally, later on, after that, when the Japanese invaded the island, I was picked up, I don't know for what reason, until I get down to Sumai. And they instructed me to train some of the crew. I think it's an officer. I can't even tell if it's an officer or enlisted man at that time. So for me to teach them, instruct them, show them how to operate that crash boat that I was operating, a twin engine. So I look at them and I say, I can't say anything. I can't understand what they were saying, but very, very little English actually. Some of them I can understand. So finally, I went inside the warehouse and I got some carapine, put in my right pocket. So I went out to I started the engine, the clutch would not engage. So I told that I was under guard. So this sentry was looking the other way, so I started opening the transmission. So I slipped out the tree, steel carapine in that transmission because I wanted to damage that. So then I put it back, everything back, adjust the clutch. I know that would not immediately ruin the engine, I mean the transmission. It would, you know, it takes time, but at least I've done something to try to cripple them. So finally, a week or two later, they came up and asked me why the transmission is not running. I said, I'm not a mechanic, I'm just a boatman, I'm just a skipper of the boat. And that's it, they sent me home. The first time they held me for 3 days, I'm confined in Suma, you know, so I can instruct those people out there. I was confined. I wasn't treated bad. I was that's under the Navy, and they gave me practice. They gave me food and Army. The mixture of Army and Navy down there.
Were there other people with you?
No, I was alone and with the. I don't remember having an interpreter, but there's forgot the name of that Japanese. He speak pretty good English. Later, you know, and he explained everything why I'm there. So start working on it, but I try to break everything as much as possible, not to make it conspicuous, you know, so I can be held back. And from then he said, you go home and make sure you stay home. I don't even have a home. So I went up and go up to my father's ranch and I stayed there. And they don't, I didn't receive any compensation. I don't know what their money looked like anyway at that time. So I have no use for money. I don't think the people have any use for money. Then they gave me a pass. I don't know what it says. It was written in their language, and for me to pin it on me. So when I go by, and you have to bow to, you know, to the Japanese, you have to put your head down and look at them. Sure, I do that because I got slapped one time for not doing it, see. So I want to make sure that I comply with what they were saying. I didn't say that I hate them. I forgive them for what they did to many other people, but I want them to know that I won't forget it. So then during that time, the families were moved to Fena, and many of them in their own private ranch, their house, they built a ranch house in their air. Then later, 1943, I think, when they start. Let me go back to my history about stealing dynamites. See, we have a person named Peter Dumanau. He's, I think, an ex-Navy man. That guy, like I said, will not bow for anybody. He will not bow for an enemy. He says he's an American. So we went up and stole some dynamites at Cabras Island. And I gave that sticks of dynamite to some of my friends and some of the family that know how to use it. I show them how to work on it, how to use it for fishing. And I want to make sure that that is the way they should be doing. Catch the fish and feed their family. And the last trip that we made, it's a beautiful moon. There's no cloud, you know. We went to pick up dynamite again. We got caught. And the two sentries, I don't know what they say, but I say maybe he said, hands up. I didn't put up my hands.
Sound rolling?
Camera? Rolling.
All History, World War in the Pacific, Mr. Perez, 92-18, take 39.
Now, I'll tell you about the dynamite. We went to Cabras Island, three of us, Vicente Sablan, Nicholas Akinios, and I went to Cabras Island. It was a beautiful moon. The last time they went up there, and we met the. We entered the dynamite magazine. I had two cases in my hand, and one case in each hand, and we started walking out. We met the sentry. I don't know what they say, maybe they say hands up or something like that, but I wasn't scared. I mean, I tried to be cool as much as possible, so I tossed the dynamite toward them. They dropped their gun and I escaped and ran down the cliff. I mean, I jumped to the cliff, over the cliff rather, and my two companions, they went down and they swam across the channel. Jump, I hurt my feet, I cut my right foot on the coral, so I took all my clothes off and bandaged my wound, and then I swam across. The two sentry were shooting at the my two companions, and the shell usually dropped in front of my face because they were about on top of me. But I wasn't scared. I try to ease myself and try to concentrate on the thing that I'm doing. So I swam across, and then later on we went across the channel. I went across the channel and I met the two guys as I swam. So finally the Pan American, the same boat that I was operating, they mount a machine gun, I think it's machine gun, because they start shooting the alongside the seashore, but they were far away from us. We were already on the other side of the channel. So we got to the seashore, and we went to a very good friend of mine, is the Rius family in Pili. That is, they have a ranch next to the Porteous area now, the Porteous area now. And we went in there and I asked for some dry clothes. So finally the Japanese squad came in, and later on, I mean, they came in and they were asking the old man if they have a canoe. He says, no, he has no canoe. And I was really furious, and I was very honest with you. I got a hold of the Mariano Canata's wife, neck, you know, and I said, if you squeal anything, I'll kill every one of you. I mean at that time. And then there's no way that because I will not surrender on anything, I want to look after my people too. But they're very fortunate, they're very brave too for killing the Japanese that we're not there. So after that, the Japanese and the old man took off to investigate the canoe, check on the canoe that we were using. They found some dynamite in the canoe. So as we dressed up, we walked out. The following day, two local authorities came to my ranch and arrested me. And then arrested the other two of friends of mine. And then from there, they took us to
local authorities?
No, not local. Not interpreters, no. They're our own local people there that picked me up in my ranch. And then they took me to the college Suncho. I don't know what Suncho is. Well, they took me down to Suma. That's where the Navy Marine Barracks is located. And when we got down there, they put us on the tailor's room. No, nothing in there. We're just on the deck, sleeping on the deck. So they start conducting the investigation. That is the hardest part, you know. They took Akinemo first, investigated him. And they put him away, then they picked me up. And I don't tell them the truth until later on. They almost break my jaw, they tie me like a hawk. They drown me, they whip me. And this one Saipan, he's the interpreter. I think it's Manuel Sablan, I think it is, Manuel Sablan. He hit me twice, and you know, after the Japanese, you know, three Japanese hitting my jaw and drowning me. Then the last time, he came and sat on top of me again to whip me, you know, I slapped him in the face. I mean, not slapping, hitting me with his fist like that, you know. So he looked up and he cried, and he says, please tell the truth, because your friend already told the truth. So I thought they were just trying me out, you know. So I said, no. So again, they do it again, slap me again, drop me. And he said, I won't hit you anymore. So he looks up and starts crying. That is when I said, yes, after all the torture with me. Then the other person, Vicente Sablan, they even crack his head. He won't tell him yes or no. He just said, no, I didn't go to Cabazana. We didn't see any dynamite. Then after that, that evening, after everything was revealed, they feed us, they give us rice and everything that we wanted to eat, you know. Not that we wanted, but they available, they give it to us, they give everything. They had a movie. They call us to watch the movie. So my friend said, why are they doing this? I said, well, maybe they got food, a lot of food, and they want to see the picture too. I know what the intention is, but I'm not afraid. So then the following day, they took us to, the cemetery. That is when Mantanoña and Acosta, when I see that. Mantanoña was on the right-hand side, and Mantanoña on the left-hand side. I was next to Mantanoña, was watching the firing squad there, Japanese firing squad. And before they commenced the firing of those two guys, Vita Gomez, Jose Vita Gomez, he's the big chief, you know, here. He said, tell the truth. I looked at him and said, yeah, I will tell the truth. So they shoot the guy, and fire squads took the action, and Mantanoña fell in the grave, but Acosta didn't. He was he didn't fall in the grave. So they took us back again to the duck shell again. That is prior to the severe punishment, you know, when it was. But I didn't tell him anything. And they told her they're going to, if you don't tell the truth, we'll execute you. I said, I don't care. I looked at those two guys. And he didn't say, ouch. It didn't hurt. Then they summoned my wife, my family, you know. My wife and my two children, my three children were crying. I said, don't cry. I said, I'll survive. And one man, Comoran, that man is brave, really brave. He wants to give his life because of us, because he's not married. He says he wants to tell the Japanese that he is the one that steal the dynamite. That's prior to what I was saying, you know. And I said, no. My friend says, yeah, please, Ben. I said, no, hell no. We did this crime. Another crime. We went out and sealed the dynamite ourselves. So it's one for all. One die, everybody die. You know, that's the way I feel. So then, after that, they took us to Agana, and they beat me up again. Then, later, the sentencing came up. Three of us, you know, they cut our hair off, bald-headed. And the judge looked at us. I was the youngest among them, too. So they gave me 5 years on the preliminary sentence. The other guy was, I think, was given 10 years. That's in the preliminary sentencing. And then Vicente Sablan, Comoran, they call him Comoran, gave him a death sentencing. And we looked at each other. I mean, there's no remorse or whatever it is. I mean, dying is something that everybody will die. So finally, the jury, I think they have jury, and they went in there, and it took them maybe 10 minutes, they went out. So you and Paris, one Namulik Paris, 5 years, remain 5 years, the other guy will remain 10 years. The other person, Vicente Comoran, will begin giving 10 to 20 life, 10 to life in prison. Then from there we went out. And that I can see that the police department is not adequate at that time, you know, the Japanese. Because there's after 2-3 days after we in cell because of the dynamite that we stole.
Where were you in prison?
Yeah, I was in prison, yes.
Where?
In Agana. So another bunch came in. We captured, we're fishing with dynamites. I know those family. And they locked them up. But they have connection in the Navy, you know, the Japanese Navy. So they released them. That officer, I think it's the governor, the naval governor, said release all this dynamite case, and they release us too. They made a mistake.
Okay. Oh, I'm wrong. I'm rolling.
This is voiceover only for Mr. Paris.
Where what did we ended there? Oh, that's in Agana, right? When I was held in prison in Agana, we usually escape at night and come back on an actual time. You'd have to be prompt.
How did you do that?
Well, the ceiling was damaged by the bombardment, you know, and the ceiling, and what's his name is Suriano, Flores, myself, and three other people, you know, we usually escape. We have a rope there that we slide down, and after we get off from that, they roll the rope back, you know, and then we proceed with what we're supposed to be doing outside. Then we get back at about 3 o'clock in the morning. Make sure that you're 3 o'clock in the morning, you're there. And they climb up and then stay in bed. They're not really, they don't know what the police look like at the time. I remember when the American released their The shell, they struck the north side of the jail, and it was about 5 to 6 feet. And that shell struck the bulkhead on the close to the shower, and I was about 6 feet away from it, and did not explode. We were really fortunate, because if that thing would have exploded, it would have killed a lot of the inmates that we had there.
How many people were there?
Oh my gosh, man, you don't have to be caught stealing. They come up and accuse you of stealing, they'll put you in jail. That's the rules. Man, I'm not going to deny that because I've seen people were in there that were accused and not doing the damn thing. They just put them in jail. And the worst part of it, when they arrested you, they whip you. They got the horse whip. They hit you in the back, they tie your hands and strike you with their whip. That is the way out there treat their prisoners. And I remember back when one of the interpreter, Francisco Pangilinan, the old man, we call him Mamaon, he liked to chew Vietnam, you know. We were shooting dice, you know, we're using Japanese money. And he went in there like entering a cattle corral. And he whipped every person that looks at him. Just don't know who you are, just turn around and start whipping you. I wasn't whipped at all because I know how to escape. So then another thing, you know, this ex-Marine, the retired Marine, Mr. Brown, married to a local, I think it's... The wife is Inasha Brown. Inasha Brown, the wife. That old man during the bombardment, you don't see no Japanese around in a gang. Talking about the civilian. So I already got out from the prison, escaped. So I know that the old man was there. Nobody let him out. So I went back. So I went in and I got him some water. And titilis, hard, you know. So I gave him water. I took the 1 gallon can and slide it underneath him. And then he had a can inside and I poured water in there. And then I gave him titilis and I told him what to do. He's an old man. And I said, soak that until it's softened and then you can eat that. Then I took off. Then right after I left that place, they bombed, American bombed that place. I don't know whether Mr. Brown was still there or not. But that again, the jail was smashed. But I don't know whether Mr. Brown was there, still there. But before that time, when I gave him that food, he was there. The old man is a white man. He's an ex-Marine. And let me see, the other thing that I'm more interested in is this family, you know, Scabellori. His father is he's in the police department. When we go out to the farm, small farm they have up there, he goes out and, you know, get us some food, you know, extra food for us, like chicken or something like that. But this other family, Mrs. Nelson. She will cook for us and hide the food and give to the prisoners. But in return, we go out and steal some sweet potatoes and taro, you know, and give it to her, you know. And because it's right next, close to that place, to that area. That is...
The prisoners weren't being fed?
Huh?
Were they being rationed, given any food or anything, the prisoners?
Oh, yeah, they give you... when you say food, you mean something... that would energize your muscle or anything, but no, you get a scoop of rice and I don't know what they give us, they call it like a buñuelos, you know, donuts, small donuts. We call that soup, I don't know what kind of soup we have, it is, but there's no ingredients in there, that's just It's for not even wild animals would need that. But we have to eat, you know, you have to eat. But Mrs. Nelson, I would salute that woman, that old lady, Mrs. Nelson. She is the one who helped us a lot, helped this person a lot. Can Lori help us a little? And the former chief of police, Mr. Roberto, that man hate Japanese. He has to work. They pull him because he's the chief of police before, and they need him there. But they didn't make him a chief of police, they make him a guard. And a Japanese would instruct him, hey, you do this, you do that. He has to do it, you know. I have seen the family of the Dumanals, Say Dumanal, married to my stepmother's sister. He was killed because he won't comply with the Japanese instruction. But that man didn't know anything about it. Our own people invited him. He says, everything is settled. You come with us. They won't do anything. He agreed with it, and what happened? They killed him. His brother was killed. Peter Dumanal's wife was killed. They just want to get rid of the Dumanal. I seen the Dumanal was chasing Mr. Juan Cemento. He was the Sunchu at that time, he's the mayor at that time, you know, during Japanese occupation. He was chasing him with the 45. And the person who stopped those two, Dumanal, is Mrs. Kwan Rehina and her husband, Taylor, stopped them at the entrance of the door, crying not to shoot Dumanal, Sarmiento. When he turns around, he met Luis Pangilinan. Luis is a Japanese interpreter. So Dumanal just got out, you know, had a rheumatism before and prior to that. And finally, when he met Luis, Luis don't know who is Dumanal. Dumanal doesn't know who is Luis. But Dumanal suspected that is a Japanese interpreter because of the leggings that they're wearing, the uniform. So he draws the 45 out, and he cocked it and tried to, when he pulled the trigger, it didn't fire. Luis turns around, pick up a small machete like this, like a souvenir machete, you know. He picked it up and he judo Dumanal, and he stabbed him right here. Dumanal, as he lay down, he picked that up, he yanked it off, and towards Luis, but he missed. Takibana came in, and the same 45 that Dumanal fired, he loaded that, and he shot Dumanal. I was there at that time.
This is a new take, number 7. We're still doing oral history with Mr. Juan Perez.
What you're trying to say is, what is most important for my children to know? First thing that I want my children to remember, one thing, is to forgive, but not to forget, though, because of the tortured, the discomfort that caused my family, and is for them to stand high of their belief as the most important thing, and not to stretch it in any way, tell the truth, and then the truth will set them free. That is the most important thing that I have lectured my children. I mean, I don't want them to come up and say, they see this, I don't want those things, because I want them to, the actual problem that they know is for them to expose, then from there on you could do what is the best. And what is the other thing that you want me to reveal one of the other things that mostly you want me to say. Well, in England, like I said, this one Marine that entered there, after I shot this person down, he escorted us up to, later on, other Marines came in. I don't know what they are, but they're in the armed forces. Yeah. They took us up to, they lead us up, to Mount Tengo. I'm from Mount Tengo. These amphibious truck came in, come up, and then we load our stuff. Then we went from there to Agat, I don't know where the concentration camp is, a camp there, where all the local people were there, they were stationed there. And then from there we start try to ease down on a lot of things, you know, try to wash up, try to clean, see what we have. And then after that, the following day I went to the 59 Battalion, where Dr. Jenkins is the commander, Lieutenant Commander Jenkins. I went and I was interviewed, and I told him, I says, I know where the Japanese army are concentrating, where they are now. So I was, I went to the Island Command, that is in Upra, under 10. I think General Larson was there, and they interviewed me. They had a moving picture camera, something like what you have here. It was a big one. And I pointed the area where I know where the Japanese are moving, up in Jigo, up in Baidero, you know, going to the northwest field. So those are the area when I pointed. Immediately, you know, when I looked out there, me and some of my friends, then we saw the bombers were heading toward the direction they were shooting down there. That is where the most of the Japanese are concentrated, where they concentrated the last time. And let me see what else can I remember about the many things.
What about Suman going back?
Going back to.
Could
you
say what it
looked like and describe what Suman is? You know, Suman is a ghost town. The ghost town actually, when the people out there.
When did you return?
No, we don't return. We never did return.
Did you ever go back?
No. When the American invaded the island, we are out. We're in our own farm, in our property, in like in Upra and someplace else. But they need that area, so they say you move up to Santa Rita. But not before that. They told us that they make an arrangement for the people of Sumai to move to Talafofo, that alongside the beach, what they call Ipan? That's not Ipan, is it? Talafofo? Ipan, yeah. And the people of Sumai rejected that. We don't want that. Then they turn around, they want us to move to join with Agat. And you all, our people are, so they say they don't want to move and mix with the Agat people. Because we have a lot of, you know, misunderstanding problem, had little fights there, you know, neighbor fight. So they say, okay, Santa Rita, they start building a thatch roof. I was appointed, at that time I was appointed as assistant commissioner of Agat during General Larson time. And then later I was appointed the commissioner of Sumai for Santa Rita. That's our village now. What do you have? There's nothing you haven't.
So you never went back. You never.
No, there's
back.
Nothing to be. There's nothing there. Actually, when the Americans start bombing the place over there, I mean, they have to bomb maybe everything in there. Even the cemetery actually was. Ever been down in the cemetery? See those holes there? Those shot by Japanese probably and American bombs or whatever it is. Our church was destroyed. Everything was destroyed actually in Sumai. There's nothing in there that you can salvage. There's nothing you can salvage. It's a beautiful, one of the most beautiful towns, here in the Alamein.
What was it like before?
Tranquility is the word for that village. Not a village. Don't say village. We call it a town because it's a very lively place, rich in everything, in resources, natural resources that we have. The sea is plentiful of shells and anything, fish. Inland is everything, we've got everything in here. We have the cable station, we have the Pan American, we have the Marine Barracks, we have the Navy. We, matter of fact, they even built an island there. They call it Nap Island. The military built a small island there just for one minesweeper, the Napa. That was the Napa. The other one was the Penguin, USS Penguin, that scuttled out of Rota Peninsula. A little further down, because my uncle, Jose Aquino, Paris Aquino, he's a chief or first class at the time, he's an engineer. So I know he's the one actually revealed that they scuttled there, the USS Penguin. I bought that Penguin, it's a beautiful, a small ship, but it's beautiful. Got only one, not a 6-inch, small gun, I don't know what they say, but they have only one cannon there that I know of. What else do you want me to tell?
How many people were living in the village before the war?
Shit, less than 1,000 people, I think.
But that was a lot for that area.
It's a lot, yeah, it's a lot for that area. It's a family get together there. And family, they have, we had thatch roof before. One house would say they put up a thatch roof, and all the families will there help. They're not expecting any compensation, no. They help each other before. They won't ask you, say, pay me and I'll do this, no. You want me to help you. That is the beautiful language. You want me to help you. That's a beautiful language that the people are so white.
It must have been hard being relocated from
a of course,
Santa
yes.
Rita. You grew up and when you became the commissioner of Santa Rita. So when did, of course the people wanted to go back there at one time or another. Were you?
We always wanted to go back there. We'll relinquish everything that we have now and go back to our home.
When were you able to?
We can't do that. It's actually the it's already, the military, I'm not saying that they did wrong. I think they did the right thing. They are the people actually that stay in front of us and say, hey, I will shield you. I want you to survive. So give them credit, I'll give you everything, because when they're bombing the island, everybody was crying. We were singing Uncle Sam. When Uncle Sam gets here, everybody says, Uncle Sam is no good. So, just the reverse. I don't know, people have different thought. But my family were in the armed forces, every one of them, an exception of me. I got into politics. But Suma is a beautiful town, one of the most beautiful towns. We got everything. Beautiful people and beautiful people, they help each other. That is important. No, hell no, they can't help. They won't help you anything. Say, how much you pay me? Even your own children say, hey, get any money? But before, they don't ask for money. Help is the word. We'll help you. At night, we start moving at Coconut Leaf maybe the following day or 2 days, they're going to put that out. And the families would go there and help them with that coconut leaf. And it's not only 500 pieces, yeah, maybe 3,000 pieces, but you have enough people there to finish that. Then they kill a cow, they kill a pig, and they invite everybody, they eat over there, and what they left over, give it to somebody else. See? What else do you want me to tell you?
Would you like to add anything?
No.